So our hope for today is to try to look a little bit at the question we left off with yesterday. And again, to try to especially focus on the aspects that tap into some of the larger questions of the concept of ksuba. As we mentioned, our sugya, beginning of second parak here, on Tezvav Midbeis, is addressing a conflict, a dispute between the husband or his side and the wife or her side, whoever is on either side of the equation, as to the nature of the original ksuba. Now it's the moment of a divorce or of a widowhood. And the question is it a psula ksuba that gets 200 or is it a non-psula ksuba? And we went through yesterday some of the possibilities of why the premise, why the default would go to one side or the other. And now, today, we wanted to focus on a specific aspect of it, that normally when you have a monetary obligation, when you have a claim, one party to another, Reuven says to Shimon, you owe me money. So Shimon, if he says, I never heard of you, I don't know who you are, I never met you before, we have no relationship whatsoever, I deny the whole thing. So Shimon is pata. But if Shimon says, you're right, I did borrow money from you, but not as much as you say, I only owe you $50, not $100. So then that's called modeh v'mikzas, and modeh v'mikzas shifts things a little bit. Still on Reuven's shoulders to prove his case, but now Shimon is not able to completely run away from it as easily as he could otherwise. He's acknowledged some involvement in the issue, and therefore he has to take a shvua min ha-Torah. This is a serious shvua to establish that he is indeed innocent. And we mentioned yesterday a little bit of the background, why there is a din of modeh v'mikzas. You can understand from a couple of different perspectives, just in a very basic conceptual level, you can say that the person has acknowledged that he is a part of the picture, that he's acknowledged that the sibas hachiyuv, that the reason for there being some debt does indeed exist. So now the quarrel is just on the number, it's a very different playing field. So now he can't simply say, listen, I got nothing to do with you, leave me alone. He becomes a little bit more responsible towards the conversation, and he has to take a shvua. We mentioned also the Gemara in Bava Metzia. You could have said that's enough to explain it, but the Gemara says a little bit more than that, that in general, a kofar bakal, somebody who denies the whole story, so he has also ne'amanus, because we're assuming that to deny the whole thing, especially if it was a loan, that takes a certain degree of chutzpah. That means you have to be able to say to a person who did you a favor, who helped you out, the chesed, the midah of the week, the time when you most needed it, Chavetz Chaim Sefer, Avos Chesed, is almost all about lending money. That's the think of examples of Chesed, you think of all kinds of other examples first, but the mitzvah HaChesed that other Sfarim you see a lot of attention paid to is the Chesed of lending money. So somebody who did you this paradigmatic Chesed, you're going to say to him, ah, go away, I never heard of you before. So the Gemara says, that's too much chutzpah. Yeah, the average person is not going to do that. So maybe he really did borrow money, and he's going to say that instead, the number is smaller. That's a more reasonable lie. So when he says, I did borrow money, but the money is smaller, his nemanis gets shifted a little bit. Now he has to take a shvua. So that adds another element to the logic of modeh v'mikzas. I have to figure out to what extent that's relevant at all over here. Are you?
I was about to say, it doesn't sound relevant to ksuva because...
Right, so it's a good question. Right, so the whole chutzpah aspect a little bit confuses things. You know, chutzpah in general gets in the way of things. Right, so to say how chutzpah plays a role here is not 100% clear how central it is to the whole discussion. In general, you have Rishonim in Bava Metzia who raised the question of maybe modeh mikzah should really then be limited only to a case where there was a halva, where there was a loan. Because if the whole point is you're not going to deny the debt to somebody who did you a favor, so if he didn't do you a favor, then we don't have the same kind of logic. So that's itself a fair question to ask, especially because, again, you could have said this without this. You could have said simply that when you're modeh v'mikzas, you acknowledge a major part of the story, and that already now puts a bigger burden on you to engage in the conversation. When if you're kofar bakal, then you say the whole thing never took place in the first place, so then it's really his word against yours, and you're the mukhzak, so you have the right not to get involved. Hi.
Also, in terms of we would give more because he acknowledges that there is a relationship that alone, whatever, it's not really connected to this to the case of Ksuba, because he can't very well deny that he was married.
Oh, so that's something I want to kind of start off with here. So that's an important point. So all of what we've seen so far about Ksuba and the relationship and the like, how does that affect the question? So what would you think? In our situation of our mission, as Akiva has brought us home here, so if the wife is claiming she gets a 200 Ksuba, then the husband's claiming, no, it's 100 Ksuba. Is that a Moda B'Mikso situation? Does that really match what we've just talked about as far as the classic mode of Mitzvahs and Bava Metzia and elsewhere? So what do you think? So first of all, just on paper, so the Rishonim have different attitudes towards this, right? Just in terms of who the players are. So on the one hand, who most prominently says that it is a straight-out mode of Mitzvahs? The Rambam, right? The Rambam says in Hilchos Ishus that there is an obligation of a Shua HaTorah. There's an obligation to actually take a Shua as a Din Min HaTorah, because this is a straight-out mode of Mitzvahs. Now, other Rishonim disagree. The Ravid over there disagrees. The Rush disagrees. And the disagreeing comes from a couple of places. So in some cases, it's technical. In other words, basically acknowledging that yes, this is a mode of mixas, but there's a detail which gets him off the hook, doesn't have to take a shvua. While other Rishonim, or other inches within the same Rishonim, will take a more fundamental approach and say this is not really a case of mode of mixas. Right? So why would you say that this is not mode of mixas? The Maisa, she's saying 200, he's saying 100. What's the difference between that and a classic mode of mixas? So what differences could you possibly suggest?
Right. So one thing Rishonim mentioned is, forgetting which one, is that there's no such thing as mode of mixas when it comes to a lien on land, which is ketuvah.
Oh, so that's a major discussion in the Rishonim we'll get to. I want to push that off because that's in the category of the second world, more technical answers.
As a technical?
Yes, a technical answer, because the Rishonim who say that, they're really saying that you're right, mode of mixas is a problem. But there's a technical answer. It happens to be Shubha Karkos, and I'll explain in more detail in a second, but I think that's a different kind of answer. So first, I just want to discuss the Rishonim who address it more fundamentally and say, Modem Mixus, what are you talking about, Modem Mixus? This is not Modem Mixus. Why would it not be Modem Mixus?
There's no other option for the guy to claim, you're going to claim that you're already called
that. Ah, okay. So one angle, as you find in some of the Rishonim, right, the Rush mentions this, and others mention this, that the premise of Modem Mixas is usually like you have options. That your Hoda is in something that you could have chosen to be Moda or not be Moda. And if, practically speaking, and I'm not going to get bogged down right now on why exactly he's not able to be Kofir, but for any number of reasons, he can't really deny this 100 debt, this basic Ksuba. He's not in a position to really get off scot-free. And therefore, this is not a classic hodah for that reason. So to use that as an approach, I think that's essentially saying that mode b'mikzas is about building off of your basic hodah, putting significance in the part that you acknowledge. And in order for that acknowledgement to be significant, it's got to be voluntary. It's got to be something that you could have done or not done. And that if that's not the case, you wouldn't have had an option of getting out of it. So then we can't take that and run with it. We can't really put too much on that. Kiva?
Another reason, maybe it's rephrasing of the other reasons. The disagreement is not whether you owe 100 or whether you owe 200. It's more whether you owe an additional 100 over the 100 that absolutely has to be paid. How that's different from the normal mode of mixas case is something that will occur to me.
Well, but let's work with that. I think you know you're right about that. And I think that's kind of the flip side of what we just said a second ago. That what we said a second ago is that you just don't have control over the part that you're mode, so we can't build so much on that. But the other side might be to really focus on this separate 100 and say it's really not connected to the other 100. Again, I'm glossing over the issue of whether we use the same monetary system for both. Let's assume that it's a straight, just for simplicity's sake, we're going to refer to the non-Basula Ksuba as if it's half, as if it's the other 100, even though, again, translated into actual dollars, the numbers, differences might be very vast, but it's just much simpler to talk about it that way. So it does seem to be that there's a big path to take to say that the 100 of the non-Basula Ksuba is one thing. It's a whole separate discussion. And they're arguing about the Basula part, which is a different track. And therefore, the Hodah that he's making really doesn't connect at all to the claim she's making. In other words, there are many different ways, and the Rishonim say this only to limited degrees, but we can fill in a little bit more, that normally a Hodah, like we said before, maybe a Hodah is an acknowledgement that you're a player. It's an acknowledgement that this conversation has some starting point. But in this case, it's not really true, right? Because there are basically two different facts being debated. Were they or potentially being debated. Were they ever married? And was she a Basula at the time of marriage? So he's saying, were we married? Okay, I can't deny we were married. That's pretty objective. That's a matter of public record. So fine, but her claim for an extra 100, it's not a matter of degree, it's a whole different issue, it's a whole different question. So his acknowledgement of the marriage fact doesn't lend any credibility at all to the Psula fact. It doesn't open that conversation to any extent, in any way that's parallel to somebody who borrowed money saying, yes, I borrowed something, but it's a smaller amount. Okay, that person is opening up the conversation saying, this thief is there, I just dispute the number. Here he's saying, you're telling me you're psula. I say, at the time, it's completely not relevant. So he's not acknowledging anything. So it's a slightly different, the inverse of the previous point. It's not that he has no choice but to be mode of the part of mode of that. Okay, I'm mode of the part of mode, but it's got nothing to do at all with what you're claiming. And there is a couple of different places to come from in making that point. First of all, just in terms of the halachas of Moed de Mikzot, just to mention a couple of points. So first of all, Moed de Mikzot, the Gemara says, it doesn't apply if the response, the hodah, is not mimin hataina, meaning I come and I say you owe me shawarma, and you respond, no, I didn't borrow shawarma, I only borrowed pizza, so here's pizza. So even though you could translate pizza and shawarma both into money, and say, okay, shawarma is worth $5 and pizza is worth $2. So let's say it's like you're asking for $5, I'm acknowledging $2. But the Gemara says not that way. It says two separate claims completely. So my acknowledgement to the pizza debt, it's as if we're just talking past each other. I'm not talking to your claim at all. So that itself could be a model for splitting the discussion here. In addition, you also have another concept the Gemara talks about, some machlokas in the Gemara. There's a notion called Hela. Are you familiar with Hela? So just to say it as briefly as possible and to gloss over any machlokas about it in the Gemara. But basically what Hela does is, let's say you come to me and say, I owe you $100. And I say, no, I owe you $50. But the difference is, I owe you $50, here it is. Here's the $50. Right? So now, right away, it's as if I took the 50 out of the equation. So now you're coming to me with a claim for 50, essentially. I'm saying, 50? Never heard of you. But the Haluch basically makes this into a settled deal, takes it out of the equation. And now I'm Koper Bakal, really. I'm not the mode in the mixes. So in that case, that seems to also provide some kind of foundation for distinguishing here, saying, listen, again, you know, here's your marriage ksuba, fine. But I'm not disputing that. But the Basula thing is a different discussion. They didn't acknowledge anything about that. Now, to make it more ksuba specific, this also draws on what we've been talking about the different elements of a ksuba, and of a Basula ksuba, and of a married ksuba. And especially if you really claim that or if you really see that they are two different cheftzes completely, all the more so it seems logical to distinguish between them. And it seems logical to say, especially Laman Damar and the Gemara and Daf Yud, that Ksuba is Daraisa, and everything else is the Rabbanan. So he's saying, okay, the Rabbanan I acknowledge, but this Daraisa concept that you're bringing up, I don't acknowledge anything. And say it's not mode to mix us for that reason. Again, the Rishonim don't go that far really in explaining that concept, but you probably see a little bit of basis for this. The Ramban quotes the Rishonim, they didn't give this to look at. The Ramban quotes the Rishonim, who basically says it's as if he's really talking about a completely separate claim. And the Rush, which maybe you did see, the Rush does talk about Halach as a possibility, right? And also about not being able to be kofer. The previous point the Rush addresses going in both directions. So those are in terms of fundamental objections to Moed Dibur Mitzvahs being relevant. And those objections go to the core of the nature of a ksuba and the nature of the difference between the two types of ksubas that are being debated. Morty?
The Rush was saying Halach, you're saying that when he tells the woman that I marry you, he gave her the money right away.
Not necessarily. I think the point is that it's ki'ilu that. Maybe that means, maybe practically it's happening too. But I think that the point is that the relevance of Halach is just like Halach kind of splits the tanya and makes it into two parts, that here it's also two parts, that okay, here's your conceptual leave and here's your theoretical marriage ksuba, but I get nothing to do with the psula issue. The two separate points. So Halach has the effect of essentially breaking the claim up into two parts, one that you've taken care of already and one that you deny completely. And so to here, the claim can be bifurcated and have no hoda whatsoever to your claim of psula. So again, whether the Rush, as I was saying before, but how the Rishonim don't really take it this far, but they maybe open the doors, I think the Halach opens that door, the Ramban opens that door, that this is just simply a split timing. But at the same time, so we find that a number of Rishonim invoke a more technical consideration, which Ari was saying before. So Ari, you want to come back to that point?
Yeah, I remember it was the Ravid.
Right, the Ravid and the Rush. Right?
The Ravid and the Rush.
Want to comment on that?
No, it's not on that. Can I ask a question about what we were just talking about?
Yeah,
before?
Sure.
Why is it that paying back the part that I was moved to would divide it, the Halach? Why would that make it two separate claims?
So it seems like it's really a technical distinction, and we could spend more time talking about how Halach works, but it seems like essentially it's not as fundamental as Ksuba might be a more fundamental point, but that Halach essentially just practically bifurcates it, that since I've taken care of this debt, so now you can't claim that I'm owed more than I admit, because I don't admit anything, and that even though...
But it was all one claim to start out with.
Right, so that's why I think in the case of Halach directly, it's more of a technical point. In the case of Ksuba, it could be more fundamental. But in the case of Halach, what it seems to accomplish is, essentially, I don't acknowledge any open deal, because by Halaching, I have now reduced the nature of the claim, so technically it's a kofer hakol.
Do you think that there's any psychological reason we could ascribe to this? Like we came up with a great explanation as to why a motive makes us pronounce it like a shua, but a kofer bako would not. We said that it's too maze for someone to just lie to say that there's nothing. Why is this guy not so maze now that he's paying half?
Right. So how exactly Halach works as far as revealing any fundamental principle? It's a worthwhile discussion. Maybe we'll come back to it because it'll take us a little bit into that sugya a little more deeply. So for now, we'll treat it as a technical point. We'll see, maybe we'll come back to talking about it a little more. But it's a little more of a Bava Metzia sugya, and it gets involved in two opinions of the Gemara, two versions of it, so it'll take us a little bit far afield. Okay, so, but what about the more technical point here? So what were you saying before, Arya? So what's the...
So the Rav and the Rosh, they mentioned that Motiv Mitzvahs does not, according to the Gemara itself, even, well, they don't mention the Gemara necessarily, but...
Other than mentioning the Gemara.
Right. So it could be a Gemara in Ksuvos, it could be a Gemara in Bava Metzia, it could be a Gemara in Shavuos. These are all different places where there's no motive, where the Gemara mentions there's no motive to mix us when there, it comes to admitting to a lien on a property or a debt.
Right, there's no Shavuos.
There's no Shavuos for motive to mix us.
Right, so, or no Shavuos at all, and no Shavuos for mix us, that when there is a Shibur Karkos, when the debt under discussion is tied down to collectability from land. So then, the gezeiras hakasuv, that there is no shvua on that. Why exactly that's true is an interesting discussion. Maybe come back to that also. It seems to be that the land provides its own kind of security for the loan itself, and therefore the extra support that's necessary from the Shvua doesn't get called in. We'll talk about that a little bit more because it plays a role. But for now, we'll just take this as a given that if there's karka connected, so there's no Shvua taken, so normally a person shouldn't have to take a Shvua. So that's how, let's say, the Rush and some others say, okay, if you ask me, why is this not Modi B'miktzas, I'll tell you, because of this exclusion of Kfiras Shiva Karbos. And the Raivid takes this objection to the Rambam. The Rambam says he does take a Shvua Daraisa, Modi B'miktzas, and says the Raivid, what are you talking about? It's a Kfiras Shiva Karbos. It might be Mishnah. I saw the Magen Mishnah, so he basically explains how everybody makes sense on some level, and that it has to do with a couple of different points in history. That at various points in history, the Ksuba was connected to one thing or another. At one point in history, the Ksuba was collected through Karka. That's what it was like, really, in the time of the Gemara. And therefore, the Gemara would consider it Kfiras Shibud Karkos. And that's what Arya was alluding to, that there are Gemaras that seem to say explicitly that in the context of Shvua, it's an issue of Kfiras Shiva Karkos. So the Magen Mishnah tell you, yeah, because in the time of the Gemara, that was the case, that Ksuba was collected from the Karka. And if you look at the Rambam in the same parak, in parak Tezayin, in the Lacha Hey, that's what he writes. So for Rabbi Raivin, you're right. If you look at a Lacha Hey, we understand where you're coming from. But if you look at Halacha Zayin. So the Rambam goes on to say that there was a Takanas HaGaonim that later on they also made it that the Ksuba could be collected from everything, from Metaltalin also. Right? And we announced this at the wedding also. This is a line in the Ksuba that everyone notices. What line in the Ksuba talks about this? The line seems to stick out in everyone's mind, even if you're not paying attention to all the rest of the Aramaic. So, as we mentioned in Israel, everyone's paying attention to hear what the extra number of the Tzef Ksuba is. But the line that seems to have impact is you say that Minoi Viafilu Miglima Da'al Kasboi. It's also an English expression. Now you want to take the shirt off my back. You want to take every last cent I have, the shirt off my back. So that's an Aramaic expression of the Ksuba, that the husband commits to paying for the Ksuba, and if the money is not in immediate evidence, you can take it out of anything I have, everything that's part of me will go towards this ksuba, even the shirt off my back, I am committing to being collectible as security for this ksuba.
So is Rambam saying that because ksuba is not exclusively Shiva Karkos, that therefore you can take a shvua on it like a living mitzvah, or because the possibility is there that it's not going to be Shiva Karkos?
So that's a very important question, because that's essentially going to be behind the Lechem Mishnah's objection. Because so what exactly is the significance of saying that? So if it's true that nowadays you can collect the Ksuba from anywhere, from movable property and from Karka, so what does that do to answer the question? Is it no longer Kfiras Shiva Karkos because it could also be other things? The Lechem Mishnah asked, their Gemaras that sound not like that. Their Gemaras that sound is still considered to be Kfiras Shiva Karkos, even in a case where it's a normal loan, and normal loans are also collectible from everything else, right? Normally you pay back a loan with a metaltalin. The Karkos is always just an extra track for support. So to say just because it could be collected from something else nowadays, how does that really change the fundamental nature of the fact that it's still connected to Karka? It's still Shiva Karkos.
From the other side, if the Ksuba is written with only Shiva Karkos, then would the Rambam say that you no longer have to take Shua the Mother B'miktzas, or?
Probably not, because first of all, even if you're working within, if we assume the Magen Mishnah's explanation is the correct explanation, so still probably not, because you might say that your condition isn't chal, because the Takanas HaGaonim says it has to be more than that. And then you can get to an argument of saying if this deviates from what the current halacha requires, so is it no good ksuba in the first place? Does he have to write a new ksuva? Is it the premise? There'd be a lot of paths to argue that it's not his option to write a ksuva that doesn't include that.
Mm.
What exactly that means about the ksuva, it's puzzle or it's kasher, but this requirement's still there.
What weight does the Tzadkan's government have in this particular instance? If you make a ksuva with a second wife,
mm-hmm.
there's a Tzadkan's from the Gershon.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't have a second wife to send me that the ksuva isn't
resolved. Well, why are you assuming that that's the case?
I'm
saying theoretically, if you have to.
Yeah, theoretically. Would that mean that because when
you're just trying to explore what the impact is of deviating from the common law standards?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question in general. It's actually negay halach lemaisa in some cases. But I think every cherem in and of itself, and every takan in itself, has its own kind of implications. So you wouldn't necessarily have one answer for all the questions. It could be that the whole marriage itself is fundamentally wrong, and the whole ksuba might be batal. While if the marriage is not fundamentally wrong, the ksuba is missing something, so then we have to figure out what the impact is. The impact might just be that we'll say, too bad it's there anyway, even if you didn't put it. Or we'll say, no, your ksuba is now subpar, and subpar means bilas nus, means asur to live without ksuba. So it probably requires a greater discussion to figure out exactly what the impact is. But I think for our purposes, it probably wouldn't make a difference that the Magen Mishnah, at least in his understanding of the Rambam, was saying nowadays this is how it works, so it's not kfira shiva karkos, at least exclusively. Morty?
The way the Magen Mishnah explains the rabbit, why would the rabbit be talking to the Rambam at like a different point in history, meaning the Rambam's writing?
Right, so it's a fair question. You know, the Magen Mishnah's answer really seems to be kind of making everybody happy. That everybody has legitimacy to their position. The Ravid is talking more conceptually that this was the way it was set up, so that should be how we define it. Especially because as the Lecha Mishnah point comes out, the Ravid may be stronger because who cares if it's both? If it's also Shubha Karkos, that should still do it. So essentially, there's an argument for both sides. We have elements of both. We have the Karka part. We have the extra part. So which part really defines it? You can see a legitimate machlokas there. Okay, the Ravid will focus on one part. The Rambam will focus on another part. History will play a role, because if you want to bring a Gemara into the discussion, we'll say that was before the Takanas HaGaonim. So all of it will be a part of the whole challenge, so people can pick out support for either position based on what elements we have so far. But this leaves us with a question that, and I want to make sure we get to Simit before we run out of time today. So is there another way to look at this? This whole topic of modeh b'mikzas and how it's relevant here, how it's relevant to ksuba and the whole ksuba karkovas issue, there is an extensive discussion. We won't have time to see everything, but I'll just mention, for example, was Reb Chaim over here. So Akiva, you can make this part of your project. Reb Chaim on the Rambam talks about this. Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach has a tshuva about this, and a tshuva's Minchas Shlomo. I think it's the Ayin Zayin and Chelek Aleph, where he goes through a lot of the discussions about it. Rav Vosner has a few tshuvas in his tshuva Shever Halevi. There's Avne Miluim. There's a lot of discussion about this. But we'll zero in on one particular aspect of it. So first of all, let's take a step back and look at a little bit of the history. Right? So I don't know if you guys got up to the Gemara and Daf Pei Beis. Right? But what exactly is the history of the relationship between Aksuba and Shibur Karkos? And Shibur in general. So, if you look at the Gemara, right, because part of what we want to try to figure out now, this is relevant to Morty's question, that this doesn't seem to be a straightforward discussion. Right? On some level, the relationship between the Ksuba and the Shibur Karkos is not a standard relationship that leaves everything explained. There seems to be room to disagree. Ravid says it is Shibur Karkos, the Rambam seems to not think so because of his mode of mixas. What exactly is going on? So the Gemara, at the very end of the 8th Perek of Ksuvas, tells us a little bit of the history. Right, that the Gemara, the very end, very last sugya, it says, Amar Rav Yehuda, Rishona hayukos from the Basula Masayim v'lamon amana. So they would just say, okay, I'm paying 200 for a Basula and 100 for an Amana, and they would just commit to it, and that was it. And what happened? V'hayu maskinim v'lohayu nosinashim. That there was no real support to it. There was no real backup to it. So the women were not confident that they're actually going to get this payment.
You mean there's no enforcement to it?
Well, basically, he could claim he doesn't have any money. right? So we know, for example, in contemporary law, if you drive a car, right, you have to have insurance. Because if you cause an accident, God forbid, and you could be liable from here to tomorrow, but if you have no money, so then the person who you hit is going to be out of luck. So the law says that's not good enough to say you're chayef. We have to know that you're able to pay it. Right? The same way a bank lends you money, and they check first that you have collateral, that you have a source of income, because the fact that there's enforcement doesn't always help a creditor, doesn't always help the other side. The other side doesn't just need the law on their side, they need the reality to know that you have the ability to pay it. You're not going to claim that you're bankrupt or that you're impoverished. So the car has to have insurance, and the bank's only going to lend if you show income or collateral, and the woman's only going to get married if she knows that the husband's not going to say, sorry, I got nothing, what can I do? I'm broke. So there's got to be something. So originally, what happened? So originally, apparently, there was nothing. It seemed like there was no real backup. So it was just a commitment. So if the husband said, I got nothing, so then she would get off the hook. If you look at Rashi, Rashi says, Hayu kosvin, v'lo hayu mishat nechseyim lachrayis eksuva. And Rashi writes, then after that, v'lo hayinos anashim, shol hayirotzos linos alehem, amul k'shiyamos yagari, shol nims ligvos klum, shol yorshin yetzniu, mo shol yirusha. Whatever money there is, you know, this is also a topic that comes up in contemporary divorces. And so the husband is interested in claiming as low a level of income or assets as possible. And it becomes a whole fight, proving where the money is. So here, this will happen too. And they don't have such sophisticated forensic accounting in those days. So he'll say, I got no money. Prove any different. So first, they made a takana that everything is tied up in the ksuba. And then the Gemara goes on to say, Tanya namihathi b'shona ekosu v'sula masayim v'lamana mana. And again, same story. So then they made a takana that there's some object that is keneged the ksuba they had to put in an accessible location. But then it was still a problem. That wasn't enough, right? Just to make it all about a physical item wasn't so helpful because the dying kishu koi solat, because then we have another problem, right? The whole point is that we don't want him to divorce her too easily. That was the whole point of the ksuba in the first place. But the flip side of this equation is we'll make the ksuba backed up by some physical item, right? We'll say your iPhone has to be the ksuba. Right? So especially has to be an iPhone 6 has to be the ksuba. Right? But still, that's gonna or make it an iWatch. It'll be even more accessible, right? It'll have it nearby all the time. But that's got a downside to it. What's the downside? Because we're trying to make it hard for him to get divorced. And now you're gonna make it easy. Okay, so I got the ksuba right here. So when they get into a fight, he takes off the watch, says here, take this and get out of here. Right, so that's not what we want. Right, that's going to undermine the whole thing. A lot of back and forth here as far as trying to come up with a system that's going to really accomplish what we want to accomplish. So says the Gemara, that's not so great either. That go take your ksuba and get out of here. So they would put it in the father-in-law's house. They would make it into some kind of a nice thing. So still, okay, we get mad at her and say, take your ksuba and get out of here. Ad Shabbat Shimon ben Shatach. So Shimon ben Shatach came and said, he has to write in the ksuba, kol nichsay achrayin l'ksuba. So everything I have is for you. And committed to the ksuba, and as Rashi adds here, v'lo yichad la ksuba b'metalta. And he doesn't pick the iWatch. He doesn't pick this one item which he could so easily then throw at her. It's everything that he has is chayiv. So the land, the whole story, he's not going to be able to claim that he doesn't have anything. Now land provides more security for her than movable items, because he can't so easily deny owning land. Maybe he can hide the condo in Florida, but the house that he lives in, he can't so easily pretend he doesn't have. So that provides her, on the one hand, with more security, and on the other hand, it's not so liquid. It's a whole back and forth about how this was arrived at. And then the Rambam tells you that the Gaonim, later on, in post all the story, that the Gaonim said that nowadays people do business in movable objects. Most people aren't really conducting business by land. So if you're going to say it's got to be only from land, which was at one point the way things were done, so then you're also kind of depriving her. You're also kind of making things difficult for her. So says the Rambam from the Gaonim and the others that nowadays, afilu miglim adal kasboi, everything we have is all included in the picture. So what is this, besides the interesting history, what does this Gemara tell us about the nature of the chov here? Why do things work this way? Why was there no shibud like there always is with every other debt? And if there's a shibud in general when you borrow money, so why is there no shibud here?
It seems partly as protection for the woman,
mm-hmm.
and also partly to make sure that he doesn't easily divorce her. So you got two sides.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make sure that it's easily accessible so that if she does need to be paid, then it should be able to be given to her.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, if it's too easy, then we're afraid she's going to get divorced.
Okay, so let me ask you a question then. So that's well taken. So the question of shibud, if normal monetary debts, let's say a loan, that automatically creates a shibud on the property. So why not with the ksuba? Basically, I hear your point. My question, my follow-up question to you is, so where does the shibud come in? Is it that the shibud is there, but Chazal Davki didn't want it? Because it has complications for the woman? Or is the shibud never there in the first place until it was created later? More, do you want to address that?
Yeah, to talk about that, I think there's in general that the ksuba might only kick in after the marriage is already dissolved. That while there's a marriage, there's no shibud at that point. From what they're going into, they just moved up the shibud to actually take effect during the marriage.
Well, maybe yes, maybe no, because I don't know if your first point is especially well taken, that there is something to pay attention to if the shibud really only, or if the chiyuv, let's say the chov, really kicks in at the time of the termination of the marriage. That itself is interesting. It might be highly relevant. Did the Gaonim shift that? I'm not sure. I mean, I think it seems like they did something else. They just expanded what could be collected. It doesn't look like they shifted the time period. But the point is well taken, that itself tells you something, right? The idea that the chiyuv, if it's true, and we saw a little bit about that in our introductory discussions, if the chiyuv really only kicks in at the time of the marriage ending, then that itself is something interesting. So let's go from there. So what about the shibud? Why is there no shibud normally? Now, if you see Tosfos, I don't know if I put Tosfos in the list, I don't think they did, but Tosfos basically suggests that really there should be a shibud, that this should be a normal chov, and there should be a shibud, but as Ari is saying, it just wasn't in the interest of the woman to have it done that way, so Chazal changed it. The shibud that should have been, they took it away and made it more metalton based until later on when it was more appropriate for it to be shibud.
How do you do
shibud means that your money, your property, your real estate, your land property is tied up within the debt. So if you can't pay the debt, theoretically you should be able to pay with anything. But if you claim you can't pay, then the land is going to have to pay for you. The land is going to be forfeited to your debtor, to your creditor.
So the
debtor.
Question is whether that
right, so the question is, it seems like eventually it existed. Right? Ultimately, the halacha, now it exists. But it sounds like from the Gemara that it didn't start off that way. That originally that was not the case, and Chazal ultimately made it the case. And now, nowadays it's both. Now it's land and everything else. So the question is, why did it not start off the case? This is a normal monetary debt. Why didn't it start with the shibud? So Tosfos will say, yeah, it should have, but Chazal didn't want that to be the case. But the Rambam doesn't give you any indication of that. It sounds like from the Rambam that there never was a sheep, but until later when Chazal wrapped up the land in. So what is going on here? Why should there be a difference? And if we can answer this question, right, if there's something different about the shibud, if the shibud is not the same as the shibud with a normal loan, i.e. it's not the same because it's a later institution, it wasn't inherently there, then we might understand why the Rambam feels this is a modim mixus case. Right? The Raivet says, Rambam, what do you mean modim mixus? It's a shibud karkos. So the Rambam seems to think, no, it's not really shibud karkos. Why not? So the Magen Mishnah says, why not? Because he's talking about a time in history currently when there are other things too. To which Akiva asks, okay, so what? There are other things too, but Karkos is still a sheepwood. Maybe that's enough to cancel out Modim Mitzvahs. So your question from before, what is he adding by saying there are other things besides the Karka? Does it mean if it's not exclusively sheepwood Karkos, then that's enough? Maybe. The Avnei Miluim addresses that, by the way. The Avnei Miluim, if you're familiar, Avnei Miluim was written by the Ksos HaChoshen. Right? You know, the Ksos HaChoshen, one of the towering authorities within the world of Choshen Mishpat. So the Ktzos was known for his debates with the Nesivos HaMishpat. They were essentially sparring partners on many, 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 many issues. So, but the Nesivos was much more prolific. The Nesivos wrote dozens of sparring. He had many sparring from the Nesivos in all areas of life. The Ktzos is known for three sparring. The Shev Shmaisa, which he allegedly wrote when he was younger than everybody in this room. But in case you get too much Halisha Sadas when you look at it, you know, they sometimes say that Ksos wrote it when he was 17, you should at least read it by the time you're 17, but then you could get totally intimidated because you think, wow, if he could write this, that's pretty impressive. Supposedly he wrote it for Sheva Brachas, but he clearly revised it a little later because he also quotes his son in the Shei Shmaisa. So if he was an Eloi writing at 17, his son must have really been an Eloi. You can only imagine how old he was when he was 17.
Shotgun wedding.
Well, still, I mean, again, do the math. How old can he be, right? So, yeah, in any event, it seems like he revised it later and then quotes his son. But in any event, so that still, either way, the Shmaisa is an impressive sefer, and the Ksos is an impressive sefer, and the only three svarim that we really have from him is also the Avnei Miluim. So the Avnei Miluim is like the Ksos on Evan Ezer. It's the, you know, same author. Ksos is on Choshen Mishpat, the Avnei Miluim is on Evan Ezer. But it is a slightly different style because it was published after he died. His son-in-law published it, and it was written a little differently. So it's the same mechaber, but it's got a little bit of a different feel than the Ksos. But in any event, the Avnei Miluim talks about this, that maybe the whole point of Sheva Karkos is that when somebody focuses completely on the karka as the backup for their commitment, that's when we say there's no shvuah. In other words, there's no shvuah because you can rely on the carcass, you don't get the benefit of a shvuah. But when people don't really pay attention to that, they're really paying attention to the metaltalin. It just happens to be, technically, there's also a karka backup in the background. So then that's not called an exemption from a shvuah. That's what the Avnei Miluim discusses.
Is that the
to some extent, it's in the earlier sources also. But you could take a different approach here also. And you could say that it seems like there is a fundamental issue that the sheepwood is not as real as it is in other cases. And maybe that's what the Rambam's picking up on. The Rambam's saying that the sheepwood that gets you out of a shvuah is not the same sheepwood that you find by ksuba. It's a different kind of sheepwood. And there's a clue to that from our Gemara here, not our Gemara, the Gemara in Pei Beis, that says, it seems to imply there was no sheepwood in the beginning. And Chazal put the sheepwood later. That's machlokas, by the way. The Gemara in the end of Baba Basra discussion, Shibuda Doraisa, Shibuda something which is inherently there on a Torah level, is it a takana? But it sounds like here it's a different kind of Shibuda. The Shibuda that exists by Ksuba was not inherently there, at least according to the Rambam. And Chazal came later and decided, okay, we'll put a Shibuda. So does that indicate anything different about a Ksuba than other deaths? So says Chaim Shmulevitz. You might be familiar with, you're probably more familiar with the Chaim Shmulevitz's classic Musar Sefer, Sichas Musar, certainly well known for that, but Chaim Shmulevitz wore two hats. He was both the Mashkiach and the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva in Yerushalayim. So in addition to his Musar Shmuzin, which are more widely known, he also has Svarim on Mesechtes, Shari Chaim, who's a traditional Rosh Yeshiva also. So in the Shari Chaim, Chaim Shmulevitz talks about this, and he suggests as follows. This is important. That there is a concept in halacha called called etain. Let's say somebody says to somebody else, I'm going to give you $100. What's the halachic significance of that? Is that binding? Now, before you get involved in the darim, you know, last week's parasha, so a neder is really between you and God. It's a yoredeya concept. And so whether or not there is a neder that's relevant, that's not going to be our discussion now. Is that binding in a Choshen Mishpat sense? Right? Does that create a debt between two people? An enforceable debt? So there is a discussion in general whether somebody can make a kinyan just through speech, saying, if I want to give you money, but I have no real halachic reason why I have to give you money. I didn't borrow any money from you. I didn't break anything of yours. I didn't steal anything. I'm not buying anything from you. So that's a whole discussion whether such a kinyan could be chal without any type of normal element of a transaction. But this seems like even less than that. Now, let's say a person says, I'm going to give you $100. Not that I owe you $100. I'm going to give you $100. So it's a machlokas. The Shulchan Aruch quotes a machlokas Rishonim whether or not that is something that is enforceable at all. And that's the debate. As Reb Chaim Shmulevitz notes, even Lamanda Amar, it's enforceable. It's probably enforceable on a different level. Right? That's probably not, it's not a kinyan. So you wouldn't say, for example, that there's a shibud there. You wouldn't say that if I borrow your money, so then maybe now my property is committed to back it up, because I have to back up my borrowing money from you. But if I stop say I want to give you money, so let's say I'm not able to do it. Okay, so I'm not able to do it, so it's not there. It seems like etain means that maybe I have to do it, maybe I don't have to do it, but to say that your property is going to be tied up in that, probably not the case. And as Chaim Shulevitz notes, that the concept of a shibud, as the Gemara says in Bava Basra, some of these extra makaris, by the way, I can give you tomorrow if you want to look them up. I didn't give you today because I wanted to give you the context first and we had enough to see. But some of these points, if you want, I'll add them to a list for tomorrow. The idea of a shibud, as the Gemara says, is that your nechasim are a raven for you. Your property is a guarantor for you. Just like another person can be a guarantor for you. If I want to borrow money from you, this is all the Gemara's and the Bava Basra, all these sugyas are there together, that if I want to borrow money from you, and you don't trust me, right? So, Ari, I want to borrow money from you, you don't trust me, but you trust Sammy. So Sammy comes, he says he'll be the guarantor, he'll sign together, so that if I don't pay up, you can get from him. So there's a concept in halacha, it's a fascinating concept, a lot to say about it, but the concept in halacha about of an arif. So not only is another person your arif, but your own property stands as an arif for you. That your house is your arif. That if you don't come up with the money, so your house comes up with the money. Your house becomes the money. Hi.
If you're unable to pay the person, the malga, and he collects from the arif, can the arif collect from you?
Pashtus not. There's actually three different types of arifim. So that's the whole story. Different arifim have different rules. But on the surface level, it basically means that he's accepting. It's a fascinating discussion, truth be told, because there's about five or six sheets we're showing him and how Ariv works, and then there's three different types of Arivs. So the short answer is no. The long answer is it's a much more extensive discussion. But
much more extensive, no.
Well, I mean, there's more to it, but there's a lot of different nuances to how Ariv works, and it actually ties into a narrative in Chumash, which is why it's really fascinating, and you know. Try to find time to talk about it, but it's a little bit far afield. But I have to take my guarantee we'll talk about it a different time. I don't guarantee. We'll have to find the right time to talk about it. But sorry, that's what I'm saying. I have to trust the guarantee. But in any event, so says the Gemara that your property is also an Arif, just like a third person could be the Arif, so your property is the Arif. So Chaim says it makes sense that your property is only an Arif if you have a actual chov. The way we call that in halacha is mamoni gabach. You know, my money is by you. In other words, there's property that's mine that is in your house. You have money of mine because you borrowed money of mine because you broke my stuff. Whatever it is, you have money that belongs to me. So then you have to back that up. Your land has to back that up. That's what a real shibud is. So in the case of the kinyan etain, you don't really have the other guy's money. You're making a commitment to give him money that you, by the kindness of your heart, want to give him. But it's not like a loan where you have his money, you got to give it back. You don't have his money. You have your money, and you're committing to give it. So there's no shibud there. So says Chaim Shmulevitz, that's what a ksuba is also. And that's where this really ties into our whole story. That a ksuba is not mamona itzlo. The ksuba does not mean that he has the wife's money. And Akiva also touched upon this a little bit yesterday, or touched upon it from another direction, where he said the whole central question, motzi mechaver lo varaya, part of it is we have to figure out who's the motzi and who's the muchzak. So we mentioned it's really pretty likely that the husband is the muchzak. It's pretty much the straightforward way of seeing it. But that even on any level, it's not the case. Maybe when somebody claims you borrowed money, still the person who's got the money right now is the muchzak. But the nature of the claim is that you have my money. You borrowed my money is in your house. Give it back. He says that's not what a ksuba is. A ksuba is not her money is in his house. It's not a chov in that sense. Essentially, he says it's comparable to a kinyan etin. It says that what it means is that the ksuba is a commitment from him to pay her. Which is essentially, I think it was Morty who was saying this point a few minutes ago, and I said that it's highly relevant. The fact that it only kicks in after the marriage ends, that shows you that point, that it's not that there was necessarily any chov before. It's that if the marriage is terminated, he's making a commitment, I will give you money under those circumstances. So this is a very important formulation, saying that it's not that the ksuba represents a chov that's already there. So the ksuba is a commitment to pay money. And then, more recent generations, from the time of the Gemara till the Golem and on, so Chazal built up that commitment and wanted to make that commitment as solid as possible so that it would accomplish everything it has to accomplish. And they tied in the land, and they tied in then all the metalzlin. But there wasn't a shibud to begin with. There isn't a basic, fundamental shibud. Because it's a whole different kind of obligation. And therefore, this whole discussion becomes very fundamental. The Rambam, in this understanding, the Rambam says, there's no kfira shibud karkos, because no kfira shibud karkos means when there's a real chov there that pre-exists, then the karka backs it up, and then you don't need a shvuah in order to provide any more support to it. But that's not what's going on here. Here, it's just a monetary commitment. So there's no shibud backing it up. So we revert to a normal mode of amitzvos. So this understanding is very important. It really taps into the whole nature of the obligation of ksuba. And then just to add one more point, which connects it more to our introductory discussion, so he writes there, he doesn't explain this in detail, but we can fill in the blanks based on what we've seen so far, that this mahalach that he's saying works much better, Lamanda Amar Ksuba Drabban. Right? And if we say Ksuba is Drabbanan, then it's not based on Morhab Sulas. But if it's Drabbanan, what's it really based on? Shlote Kala Bein Avlotzia. Right? And it's really about that we want to make a disincentive for divorce. The disincentive is a big monetary payout that will come at that time at the end of the marriage. So if that's what it's about, it really makes more sense that this is not something that really is a standard monetary debt. It doesn't have a shibud in the actual Torah fundamental sense. And therefore, that's going to impact how all these halachas play out. All right, I think that's a very fundamental point, a very important point. And again, it brings this discussion, which could have been kind of a technical discussion, very much back home as far as how the whole structure of the ksuba exists. And therefore this whole discussion, which could have been somewhat technical, I hope that you've been able to see that it kind of plugs in a very core way to some of the issues that we've seen about the ksuba. So I'll just quickly, we spoke about them, we'll run to Mincha. Any questions? Everything makes sense? Alright, let's quickly review what we spoke about today. So we saw that there is this question of motive and mixas, and that you could ask two questions. Do we treat this like a motive and mixas? And if not, why not? So most of the Rishonim say that there's no shvua d'oraisa, it's not motive and mixas. And you could answer it from a fundamental place. You could say simply two separate chiyuvim, there's no hodah at all on the basula part. Either you could say that his kfira hodah is not significant because he couldn't have kfira and yochal lichbarbo, or the other way around, that his hodah is not significant because he's not mowed anything connected to this. Whether you call that not mimin hataina, whether you call that halach, whether you call it something else, there seems to be a basis for that in the Rishonim, and more of a basis based on what we've seen so far. Or you could say that it's really a technical point, or it's not true at all. The Rambam says that it is mod mixas, yechayiv shvua min ha-Torah, and the Ravid says, no, there's no mod mixas because of a technical point, kfira shibur karkos, which is what the Rosh said as well. So the Magen Mishnah said that, well, the Ravid and the Rambam both have what to rely on. They're talking about different points in history, essentially. That the Ravid and also any Gemara that supports the idea that it's Shibur Karkos is because talking about when it was only Karka that was there to be collected. While the Rambam is talking about the later stage, the Takanas HaGaonim, when Metaltalin were also brought into the picture. And the Lecha Mishnah says, well, what do you mean? You're trying to say that if it's Karkos and Metaltalin, that it's not Shibur Karkos? What about other Gemaras that sound like Shibur Karkos, even though it could also be collected from Metaltalin like a normal Chov? That doesn't seem to change anything. So we noted that this really all could connect to the whole history of how this developed. That the Gemara here says that originally there was no Shibur whatsoever, apparently, and then the wives didn't really have any backup, there was no marriage, then they made it into Metaltalin, then the Metaltalin made it too easy to get divorced, so then it became everything, really primarily the Karka. And then later on, the Ram says the Gaonim indicated that it could be Metaltalin as well, so that it shouldn't be tied down to the Karka that's not really used. So the question is, what's this whole implication? It sounds like there was never a Shiva originally, and it was later. Tosfos says there would have been a Shiva, but Chazal Davka made it not that way to make it easier for her. But the Rambam sounds like there was no Shiva in the first place. So how exactly does that tie in? So we noted the possibility that maybe this is a different kind of chov. This is not a chov like a normal debt where there is a Shiva. Possibly, like Reb Chaim Shulevitz suggests, it's comparable to a kinyan etain, where a person says, I will give, but doesn't really have any reason why he has to give. So even in Manda Amr, that he's actually chayiv to do it, presumably there's no shiva because there's no actual mammon etzlo, he doesn't have somebody else's money in his position, in his possession. And he says that's also what iksuba about. Iksuba doesn't mean you have her money. Iksuba is about a commitment to give if there is divorce. As he says, it works much better, especially if you say that iksuba is the rabbanon, like the paskin, that it's all about shalot hekala b'einav l'hotzia. And then the idea that there's any kind of shibur that Chazal put on later in order to strengthen the security, but it doesn't represent the same type of shibur that you have by a normal debt. Okay, so we'll stop there. Again, God willing, tomorrow, stay tuned for Shlishi and Revi of Kisavo, and you should have a wonderful Wednesday. All right.